Owen, who knows? All right. 1 Timothy 4, if you would turn there just real quick. Is it okay if I pull this door shut, Brother Monty? Okay. 1 Timothy 4. Verse 16. Let's just read it out loud, okay? Ready to go. Take heed unto thyself and unto the doctrine. Continue in them, for in doing this thou shalt both save thyself and them that hear thee. Take heed unto thyself. We could all tell the stories of friends, people we knew, people we heard of, people we're familiar with, who for one reason or another, you know, are no longer serving the Lord, maybe in jail, who, you know, gave a black eye to the cause of Christ and to our role as pastors. Hey, by the way, it's not just one movement. It's pervasive, okay? And so you be careful about the online and the forums and the nonsense, because you know those people want to focus on one group, and we have had our black eyes, too many of them, and sometimes from the most, you know, belligerent, loudest voices. But it's everywhere. It's evangelicals, it's Presbyterians, it's Catholics, it's Methodists, it's everywhere. I got a Methodist church in my town that a lady visited from that church, and she said, here's the story, the pastor and his wife, they were co-pastors, and he was unfaithful, so he had to resign, the denomination got involved, they kept the lady as the pastor, this was bizarre, and she's still the pastor. It's just weird. And I got, you know, I hated hearing it. I didn't like hearing the story, but I thought, the Methodists have problems too. You know, it's not even just religious circles. It's institutions and organizations of every kind. You know, from, was it Penn State? Is that the, okay, you know, I mean, you name it. YMCA, you name it. You name the organization, okay? So what we're talking about in terms of these problems are pervasive in our culture. I think it's important that we all understand, and I would assume you understand this, but maybe it hasn't occurred to you, or maybe if you're younger, this will help. There's not anybody that you meet when you say, I'm a pastor, that doesn't have some kind of negative idea that comes into their mind. The minute you say, I'm a pastor, you could say about anything else. I'm an architect, I'm a doctor, I'm a physical therapist, I'm a nurse. You say, I'm a pastor, they just, all of a sudden, they have a caricature that they're going to impose on you, okay? Even at 43, when I moved to Connecticut, I was a little naive about that because I was in a bubble, and I grew up from 21 to 43, one ministry, one place, one area, no other independent Baptist churches within an hour, we had a good name and a good church, and so I never had to deal with the persona where we were. You know, people that met us, hey, we're from Lancaster Baptist. Oh, yeah, I've heard of that church. We had a good presence and people respected. When I got to Connecticut, I just didn't. It seems to me, in the short time I've been there, Connecticut for the last 50 years got like an overdose of angry pastors. You all know what I'm talking about when I say that. I have met an unbelievable number of Christians, and I know there's always two sides to the story, okay? But unfortunately, sometimes the people that left the church had good reason to leave. And of course, it's never my fault. I'm the pastor, right? It's never my fault, and it's always a purging. God's purging the church. I get it. I know. I mean, I know how the game is played. But I heard a guy one time that he had some people leaving his church. He got up on a Sunday night in the service, and people knew that some folks had left the church. And he said, well, every church needs a good bowel movement every now and then. Now, that's funny, That's funny on one level, but that's tragic. That is tragic. It's tragic that people in my area know there's a man who looks at people in his church that way. If I were a member of that church, I would have left. I would not stay under that kind of leadership. If I had family members in that, I'd say, don't sit under that. You know, now, if maybe a repentant spirit and a heart of humility and, wow, I was in the flesh, I should not have said that. But that's pretty rare, too. I mean, I bet we could all count on one hand the number of pastors we've ever heard genuinely, humbly apologize, admit a mistake, ask forgiveness. I taught the thing on marriage today, and but Monty, you've heard that message. I mean, what do I do? I tell you about all my issues in our marriage. You know why I do that? Because for 5 or 6 years, I thought everybody else had a perfect marriage, and me and Dana were struggling. Come to find out, everybody has those same exact issues. Everybody does. I was just normal. We were just normal, and we really could have used someone older than us that would take us and say, "Hey, you guys are okay. You're just stupid, and you need to know this. You're just a jerky husband who thinks you're always right, and you're not. You need to humble yourself. Okay, you're going to get through this." No, but we got this idea that we have to, we have to have this persona of perfection. And anyway, coming back to the idea of Connecticut, 6 months in, I got this thing from people that. It was like they were smiling and nice to me, but they were stiff-arming me relationally. And the reason is they were afraid of me. And they were afraid of how I was going to hurt them, because they had all been hurt by a pastor in the past somewhere. And I'm talking legitimate hurt. Like, they got preached against in a Sunday night message, and everybody in the church knew who was being talked about. Or their adult children were unfaithful and fell away from the church, and they got shamed out of the church now. You know, I'm telling you, bizarre stories. Bizarre stories of church discipline being practiced more like Catholic excommunication than biblical restoration. You know, I'm talking about public shaming like Amish country, you know. That was really common in Connecticut over the last 25 and 30 years in independent Baptist churches and stuff like that. So I come in, I find out people are stiff-arming me and afraid of me, and it took me a while to get that every time I introduce myself to somebody, I'm underwater already with them. I'm already dishonest, probably unfaithful to my wife, probably not working hard. I sat down with a couple weeks ago, young couple. They had fallen out of church because they were in a church that every message was not Bible, it was issues. Every message was off the cuff, anger, spewing, venomous, you know, just caustic. Not encouraging, not positive, helpful, feeding, it's growth, but just, you can never be good enough. You can never serve enough. You can never give enough. And they just got discouraged, and they just dropped away. Now, I'm not saying they're right. They shouldn't have dropped away, but they did. I prayed for a year that they would come to our church. And I tried to befriend them and tried to reach out to them. Took them to lunch a time or two and just said, "Look, even if you never come to my church, I want to be your friend. Because I don't know anybody in Connecticut, and I need friends, even friends that don't come to my church." That shocked them, because in their minds, the pastor always has some ulterior motive. So just having them in my house and having coffee with them and saying, "Hey, you might try that church. That's a decent church. You might, wherever you go, I still love you." You know, they were like, "What planet are you from?" And, you know, so much of what I'm going to talk about and so much of what I'm sharing with you right now ties into just insecurity. Sometimes as pastors, we're the most insecure beings. You guys are in proximity to a lot of other independent Baptist churches, I'm assuming. So there's probably people to and from churches. Why are we so uncomfortable with that? Why is that guy no longer good because somebody went to his church? I'm happy when they come to mine. Why won't I be happy for him if they go to his? You know. Again, in Lancaster, we didn't have that because there was no churches within an hour, really, that you would... This was new to me, you know, and there have been a few people that were out of church, that are back. There's a few guys in my area that already don't like me because somebody that used to go to their church comes to mine now. Never mind the fact that there's 20 members in their church that used to go to Emmanuel 20 years ago. Or, you know, it's this is nonsensical stuff. This is silly, silly stuff. The guy that's 10 minutes from us, that is the most well-known in the area, that Emmanuel's had this consistent rivalry with for 30 years, he's been a pastor there for 30 years. I just took him out to lunch. And in fact, Gary Jones, do you know him? You don't know the name? Faithful pastor, BJ grad from years ago. We sit down to lunch, and he said, "So how were you saved?" I said, "I was saved in a church in Georgia. His name was Dick Hester." He said, "Dick's one of my best friends." And we became like good buddies now. And I'm going to have him preach at my church. And my church family is going to go. Because some of them used to go to his church. Some of his members used to go to our church. Whenever Emmanuel lost a pastor, there was a big migration to his church. You know, whenever he said something people didn't like, a big migration back to Emmanuel. There's going to be that stuff. Insecurity and nonsense. But anyway, I'm underwater with people. That's my point. I'm underwater and I'm trying to dig out with people. And the role of pastor is not as respected, or there's been a lot of black eyes. I wrote down four areas where we must protect ourselves. And I'm going to walk through them very quickly with you. The first one I wrote down was, and I probably should have put these in a different order, but the first one I wrote down was financial safeguards. Financial safeguards. I'm amazed, again, coming out of my bubble, I think there's a lot that I'm amazed about. I'm amazed how many dead independent Baptist churches there are. I'm amazed how many independent Baptist pastors handle the money themselves. It's alarming. And it's really, really bad. Right? And there's a reason they handle it themselves. If you're sitting here and you handle the money, there's a reason you like to handle the money and you don't want anybody else to handle it. And I'm telling you, that's dangerous. Some of the people that have come to my church, there's one family really that's come from this church where the man said, we need a good bowel movement. Okay. Well, that man counts the money, deposits the money, writes the money, check. I mean, he is the banker for the church. And one of the reasons that this family came over was that they really lost confidence in the integrity of what he was doing, because he didn't have any system of checks and balances. And, you know, my spirit when somebody does visit from another church, I never follow up on them. I always kind of push them back and say, hey, stay in your church. You go to a good church. I don't really try to follow up on anybody unless they emphatically say, I don't have a church, or I used to go, but I'm not in church right now, something like that. I'm mostly after unbelievers. I'm mostly after lost people. But it's hard to explain, you know, it's hard to defend. You got a church of 250, 300, and you're handling all the money? That shouldn't be. So my number one thought under financial safeguards is don't touch the money. Don't touch the money. Box yourself away from the money and be able to say to your congregation, I don't touch the money. I don't count it. I don't deposit it. I don't handle it. I don't write checks. I don't sign checks. Now, you ought to direct the spending. You ought to help set the budget. You ought to have the authority to say yes and no to purchases. I get all that. I have a church credit card. And if I want to take somebody out to dinner, I take them out to dinner. And if it's a follow-up visit or a hospitality thing, that's a part of our church budget. And that's all. That's a paper trail. I'm using budgeted money for what it was budgeted for. The church has voted on the budget. The finance committee has approved all of that. But I have no authority to just take random money and go spend it. We have at Emmanuel a petty cash fund where, and to be honest with you, I'm still figuring out, you know, how do we get money into petty cash and what do we use it for? But we're going to do away with that even soon. That was the first thing that happened when we hired a financial administrator in Lancaster, is he did away with the petty cash fund because it was a leak. It was a way that money could leak out, and it was hard to keep track of. So I would encourage you to get lay people involved in counting, depositing, signing checks, reporting to them, financial reports. If you've got a smaller church, there's a layman that'll probably commit 2-3 hours a week to doing your finances and paying the bills, and you get reports, you review the reports, but get away from the money. I put down, don't touch the money. I put secondly under this, open communication. I think we have done a poor job at being transparent. Again, in the movement, this is a very general statement. Maybe it's much broader than our movement, but open communication. Unless you have something to hide, you should want open communication. You should want the church family to know. Now, there's one area that is off limits, and that is salaries. Okay, to the general public. Okay, now small churches might view this a little differently. I inherited a system where a few years ago it was private for a long time, and a few years ago the guy before me published the salaries. Worst thing he could have possibly done to the church where it was in that moment. And so when I sat down with my new budget, I said to the deacons, by the way, we from this moment forward, the finance team, I should say, we no longer announce or publish salaries. And I had one guy that raised his hand and said, you have to. I said, no, I don't. He said, yes, you do. This is money that's been given. I said, no. I said, the church will be able to vote on a budget, and there'll be a line on them that says personnel or compensation. And it will include health care, and it will include, you know, a cell phone or a gas allowance or whatever there is. It'll include all the pay. It'll include the whole staff into one lump sum. I said, we're not going to announce salaries. He said, how can you get away with that? I said, guys, you are publishing contention. Because you're going to build contention on your staff, because you know certain people think other people should make more or less. You're building into the church family this idea that everybody's the CEO of the church family. Everybody has an opinion. I said, it's either not enough or too much, and you're never going to make everybody happy. You're just totally sowing discord in the church body. And I said, if they don't trust you men enough, the finance team enough, to come up with reasonable compensation, then they can find another church. And they were shocked that I said that. But I said that to the church family too. I said, church, if you need to privately understand how we arrive at a salary, that's fine. You know, I didn't get any pushback on that though. Just the one question in the meeting, but when I announced to the church family we are never going to publish salaries, I basically said, the day you come forth with all of your income and put it on a piece of paper and post it in the church is the day we'll do that for all the other staff members. So, open communication, though, in terms of the budget, where we're at, what's going on. I was amazed. I can't get stuck on this. How long do I have? Till 4?
No, you have till 3:50.
3:50. Ooh, man. Okay. My first finance committee meeting, 7 men. I come in. My language is total transparency. Nothing to hide. We're in a mess. We're going over a cliff fast. I don't want to hide anything.
Right.
They need to know reality. But they had been smokescreened for years. Years. The previous pastors, a trail of them, had made a habit with the finance guy of fixing the report, you know, hocus pocus, you know, fairy dusting the report so that they could make it look like they wanted it to look. Bad, bad practice. I'm telling you, on that finance committee, I've got the CEO of a steel company. The guy's a brain. So I said to Dave, I said, how did you stay in these meetings without killing somebody? And Dave said, I just got used to knowing I was going to be lied to, and I had to come into the meeting deciding how to figure out what the truth was. I asked another one of my deacons who's in the secular world and successful, I said, how did you stay in those meetings and keep your head? He said, we're used to it. That's how the secular world is. Isn't that sad? So my first meeting, they pounced on me. I'm like, whoa. You know, that means they jumped on me like I'm already a guilty convict stealing money. I said, time out. You know, guys, what are you doing? And I said, what has happened here? And after the meeting, I answered the questions. We prayed. I called one of them. I said, Dave, what was that? Dave's my friend. Dave goes, Pastor, it's just what they're used to. He said, they're used to being smokescreened and having to figure out how they're being misled. So I got those same men together the next night. I said, guys, this isn't a meeting about business. This is a meeting about meetings. And I said, we don't do that to each other anymore. I said, I'm not going to lie to you and you're not going to attack me. I said, we are friends. We are in this together. And believe me, I have nothing to hide. Enough on the financial safeguards. A well-planned budget, a well-staffed finance team or volunteers. Surround yourself with men, a deacon board or finance committee, whatever your church documents require. Get some good men on there that will help you. Industry standard practices on salaries, on counting, on policies, on accounting, on annual reviews. And that was my last point under there, was an annual review and an annual meeting, reporting and letting people know where you're at. Number two, and we have to hurry, sexual safeguards. You know, I heard years ago, even as a junior higher, my junior high youth pastor, my pastor at the time in Georgia would say, there's two ways men destroy their lives, sex and money. Money and, you know, greed in women. And this is how they fail. I had a man that fell out of ministry a few years ago, who called me a few months ago. We were in school together. We're just barely acquaintances. And he called me. And he said, do you know about my story? I said, just barely. I said, I just know you were in the pastorate and then you failed and you're not now. And he said, well, let me tell you my story. And I didn't really, frankly, I still don't know why he called me. But we talked for about 15 minutes and he just told me how it happened. And he said, he said he had a secretary and there was some emotional attraction. Mistake number one. And then there was some marital trouble. You know, it's the same trap every time. And he said, I started going down this road. He said, I actually went to a couple of friends and asked them for help and they didn't know what to tell me. And he said, it got so strong and so powerful that I finally made a decision to just dive in and give in. He said, I decided to leave my family and run off with the secretary. She told me she didn't love me. She told me she was attracted to me for my stuff and for my position. He said, I'm going to leave my family and leave my church and go with you. And you're going to leave me and I'm going to have nothing. He said he knew, you know, this is what was going to happen. And he was really under a delusion. And he said, that's exactly what happened. They were together for 2 weeks. She left him. His wife left and remarried 2 years later. His kids, it's taken me 3 years. He had three teenagers. It's taken me 3 years just to begin rebuilding a relationship with my kids. He said, I lost everything. So in there, he said, there's a connection between... I'm trying to remember the verbiage he used. The idea of control as a leader. There's a connection between the need to be in control and the temptation to sin sexually. In our psyche, when you are sinning sexually, you are taking control. You are leveraging power. And leadership... gives us the illusion of control. And it could become the delusion of control. We are not in control. Leadership is a little bit of a mixed bag in terms of it. You have winsome qualities, compelling qualities as a leader that are God-given but could be misused for your flesh and for yourself. And it's a dangerous trap. This man on the phone just encouraged me. He just said, you know, just set up safeguards and make sure that you're okay. Make sure your marriage is healthy. Make sure your family is strong. Make sure you're not placing yourself in a compromised position. Now, a couple of thoughts on here. I got 6 minutes. I wrote down these two words, an open life. What do I mean? I'm talking about emails and computers and passwords and accounts and phone, everything wide open. Yes, sir, 5 minutes. Everything wide open. Somebody said to me recently, how come you don't lock your phone? Like if I left my phone here, you could just pick it up and I don't, maybe I should. But It was one of my staff guys. He goes, how come you don't lock your phone? And I go, because I don't have anything to hide. And then I smiled like... and he turned red like, oh, you know, I put it right back on him. But in all honesty, if you're married, you're going to have a wife that has a little alarm system built in. And she is going to have a sixth sense about other women. And you better listen to her. Okay? And you better decide you're not going to flirt with that possible attraction. Okay? It's a trap. And you can have the same fun with your wife.
Amen.
You know, I was with a guy, I led a guy to Christ, his name is Jack Harper. Jack took me out to lunch one day. This was like 20 years after he got saved. We were talking about being faithful to our wives. And Jack was a big black guy. Could have played football, just big. I was like my bodyguard, you know. And we sat down and we were talking, and Jack said, you know, he said, I had a friend one time that was talking to me about why would he cheat on his wife. And here, you know what, his name was Ricky. He said, you know what Ricky said to me? He said, why would I go to some other woman that's got all the same equipment my wife has? And I will never forget that statement. And I thought, how stupid are we? We have a good, godly lady that God gave us who says, here I am, I'm yours. And God says, she's yours. And she took you. She took me, you know.
Yeah.
Poor lady, you know. And, you know, I'm gonna go find somebody else that has all the same stuff she's got. It just doesn't make sense. It does not make sense. So, an open life, my wife can pick up anything, look at anything, read anything. She looks at my text messages. She can look at my emails. No secret accounts, no secret, you know. An accountable schedule. Can I tell you, if you're avoiding going home, you're on a road to fornication. The guys that stay late at work, they don't always stay late because they love Jesus. Okay? You need to go home. And you need to turn off the stuff and hold your boy's ears for a minute. But go home, turn off the stuff, and thank you. Okay. Get to know your wife. And you know what I mean when I say that. Okay? Enjoy your relationship. And don't feel guilty about it. That's what God wants you to do. Okay? You need, personal policies. Let me just say, you're never going to have sex with somebody if you don't go behind closed doors with them. Okay? So, a great policy is don't ever be in a room with a woman with a closed door unless she's your wife. That you're just not going to have sex with any woman. I mean, there's always a closed door in a room, and that's where sex happens. So, that's been my policy. There's not a woman on the planet that could say, I was in a room with him behind a closed door. It never happened. I take it back. One time with our 65-year-old bookkeeper, that happened. But believe me, there's no worry there. Okay, policies. I quickly got 1 minute. I wrote down this third category, and we don't hear about these much, but ethical safeguards. And when I'm talking about ethics, I wrote down three things. Your work ethic. A lot of people think you just play golf all the time. Some pastors do. Some pastors play golf, lay around, and Google their message on Saturday night. Okay? Your giving ethic. You know, in the old, the priests and the Levites gave just like the people gave. You should be leading in generosity. The people that count the offering should be seeing. Your deacon or whoever that keeps your giving record should see. You are all in, okay? Your giving ethic, I wrote down your behavioral ethic, the things you would say and do. You know, we shouldn't be crude in the pulpit. That whole bowel movement thing, that's really not appropriate. And then your leadership safeguards, okay? Your leadership safeguards. And I'm going to talk more about leadership in the next session. I believe in a couple things under leadership, because I think we can, our leadership can get ahead of us and get into our heads, and we can misuse our leadership. I wrote down team leadership. I believe in team leadership. I believe that while there needs to be maybe one guy that's, you know, the senior pastor, I really believe in, when you read Scripture, you're going to see a multiplicity of pastors. You're not going to see this one man guru Everybody bows to his, you know. You're going to see multiplicity. Look at Acts 13. There were at the church of Antioch. Teach. You're going to see the list, okay? Obey them that have the rule over you. You're going to see a team leadership. And I think that's one of the problems. You get one guy running the show, you're setting yourself up for problems. You need men around you. Along with that, I believe in consensus leadership. Okay, I'm not going to leave a finance committee meeting and take action on an item that was four yeses and three noes. I don't believe in plausible deniability. I don't want men in the church going, well, I voted no. Our church voted on everything. And I told them flat out, if I come here, we're not voting. The New Testament church didn't vote. We're going to vote on a budget and we're done. We're going to do the sign, we're going to paint the auditorium, we're going to carpet the auditorium, and we're not voting on it. So if you don't want to, if you want to vote, vote no on me, you know. All right, we're going to talk about the rest of this in the next session, okay? We'll stop there.